Okay, voice recording, and I'm almost out of batteries. So, don't worry. Oh, I didn't bring my briefcase, but that's okay. We'll get today's lecture. And then I will update everything on the website, because we will finish chapter 4 today. But, any questions, any thoughts, anything that really didn't work very well or has worked spectacularly that you want to share? Andy, other than wearing a giant resistor costume and winning an iPod on Tuesday. He made out like a bandit on Tuesday. Well, we were heavily favoring anything that was electrical since it was the Larry Sears lab. And you know he would favor anything electrical, but that's neither here nor there. Yes. By the way, I looked at your video. It was good, but you picked an easy stretch of road. It was straight. And it mostly had line markers.
But the handling of all of the tar marks
was good.
Completely limited Edward oncoming
tires. Mm-hmm.
Direction by averaging together multiple.
Yes. Yes. There's nothing wrong with doing multiple frame averaging. That is one way. There's all kinds of interesting techniques that you can do. One of the first is, how many frames do you really need, and how much information in each frame do you really need? And we've talked about it in class, and I know some of you have already thrown out anything above the horizon. And some of you have even, well, if they don't change much, and this is probably equivalent to your averaging in some sense, why process everyone? Do they look about the same? Throw them away. You know, just sort of go into sleep mode, you know, like when you're driving down the road and you all of a sudden look up and you say, where am I? Because you basically go into this automaton mode. How many times have you done that? Well, yeah, those things, the rumble strips will wake you up. Now, the DARPA challenge, I don't think we'll have rumble strips. And so you're not going to be able to wake up or drive along the rumble strips, although that would have been a valid approach. Could have been bad on Dexter. Yes, you could have. Yes. Well, actually, you could have a little idler wheel out just to do the rumble strip. Or we could use image processing to find the rumble strip. Although the rumble strip isn't there on gravel or dirt. And I guess Dee Dee's going out today, tomorrow, whenever, sometime in the near future, and we're going to get dirt roads, gravel roads, roads which go from asphalt to grass. But we're going to go over to Lakeview Cemetery, and we think that'll be a good place to get a lot of images, and then out to the farm. And I guess if we drove up and down Cedar, we could get some really bad roads. That's an inside joke for anyone who's driven Cedar. It is totally ripped up due to construction. And it's all dirt. Well, Fairmont's okay in some regions. Okay. Now, I suppose I'm waiting for someone to add lane markers to their images. I haven't heard that one yet. No? So, everyone's doing okay? Okay, for those of you who have not started the project, you really should get going. Okay, nothing to say? No cool ideas? I mean, yours looked good. Remember, one of the real interesting things that you're supposed to tell me, and you know, we're sitting here, we're evaluating which algorithm is going to go into Dexter, or which combination of algorithms. And in fact, ideally, it would be nice to have a combination of algorithms. So how well does your algorithm work? Where does it work? Where does it not work? Do you have a problem dealing with high light, low light? Do you have a problem dealing with rapid transitions from high to low light? Now, you did notice, in fact, I would say probably the most challenging
aspect of the whole road is going under the bridge, where it goes basically from bright sun to dark.
I think they just lost something.
Oh, where?
They have the shadow of the tree here and above, and leave the bright alley underneath it.
Okay, stuff like that, a shadow on a bright plane. Those, you know, were particularly very, very interested. Newman was in this morning asking, well, what happens when a car goes by? And, you know, I was telling him that as far as I've seen, the algorithms that you've all shown me don't get too upset when you have a passing car in the other lane. Although a couple I've seen aren't in the right lane. You know, when you're like on Euclid, there's two parallel lanes, and a couple of you have picked up the wrong lane. So tell me how good your algorithms are. Tell Scott how good your algorithms are. Tell Andy how good your algorithms are. He might have to implement them. Or I'm not sure who is going to do the vision. Just Scott? And Simon? Okay. Good. So, no questions you want to ask me? I don't know. I'll see if I have something really fast. My desktop is not known for its neatness. Let me quit this one for a moment. Let's see. This might be a better way to do it. Okay. I think, in fact, I won't use any names, so I don't embarrass you. But let's see. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's one for sure. Just happened to be on my desktop. Okay. No one's smiling over there, are they? Okay. Let's see. This one is that the original Project 2? Looks like it, which is nice and straight. Not working too badly. Although, what's that thing right there?
Well,
you didn't need to speak up.
I'm averaging over 9. That person's averaging 9.
Okay. Okay. But notice, and I hate to use this research, but notice that, you know, it's doing a real good job. You're not picking up any of the patches. And this is the thing that's really, real. This kind of stuff is what's really of interest, which is usually shadows. Now, this isn't too bad, because what's happening is that's a relatively narrow shadow in height. Okay? But if you go, like, under the bridge, really dark to really light, and you don't have much of a... it depends on how robust your algorithm is and how much you can handle it in those lighting conditions. But, for example, you may, and I'll just give you a hint, you need to process any of this stuff up here at all. Because if you're on a road, and it's a standard road, and given the optics and the camera, isn't this what it's always going to look like? Let's see if I have another one or two here. I know I have them, I just don't know if I put them on my desktop. I don't know if these are mine or someone else's. That's mine. That's just a movie. Huh. MOVs, MOVs. Oh, okay. AVIs. Let's try one of these. Oh, here's a very sophisticated one. Okay. Multiple images. And I won't embarrass people, but if anyone wants to chip in and explain what they're actually doing right here, that this is actually a very, very clever scheme where if you're looking for lines, why not just look for information that is in selected regions of the image, like boxes right here, and use other little boxes. Oh, it's getting brighter. Look for other little boxes to adjust your light level. So this is sort of downstream, a fair distance ahead of the vehicle. This is right in front of the vehicle. And this right here is something which is basically providing a driving control, sort of, to the vehicle. You're going to the left, to the right, to whatever. Cropped RGB image, and it's using yellow, white, and a yellow-white composite image. Okay, it's a little fast.
Dynamic frame skipping.
Yes, and I don't have a way to turn down QuickTime. Is there a way to turn down QuickTime? Oh. Okay.
But for very bright areas sampled by the six blue boxes.
Okay, where is the playback control? There we go. Notice, there's really not a lane marker there, and I'm not quite sure what's there. But notice what the different colors and combinations of images of colors are doing. I'll show that one in a moment. But notice dark to light. Though that one's in definitely bright. These are in fairly dark, and that one's right on the edge. But you don't need to look at the whole image. If you know what the shapes are that you're looking for. That truck sat there a long time. And this is the Cedar Road construction that we were talking about earlier. This was when it wasn't nearly as bad as it is now. And I think this is going down to Washington. And I think this is Cedar now. I'm obviously not trying to detect the crosswalk.
Frequently, you can only be in a sweet spot more than one.
Okay, and here's the big long one. This is the parking lot. There, we got the grad student. There. It's interesting to watch the colors. I know, you want to watch the one here with all the graphics, but the color images are really interesting. And it's very interesting going around. Did that nicely. And watch this guy. Okay. Probably should have slowed that down. Let's see, is that the Cornell intersection, or is that the Adelbert? That's Cornell. Notice difference in, there's definitely big difference in colors. Right. Now, don't panic, by the way, if yours doesn't quite look like this. I'm expecting most of yours to be better. Now, this is really interesting. This is really interesting to watch. Look at how bright that is there and how dark this is here. Just ram that car. The radar is working right now. Or LIDAR. Yes, that's right, I forgot. You're doing LIDAR. You notice it doesn't get very upset by anything over here because it's only looking in selected areas. Well, I guess that must have been it. So, was that useful? I know. Newman could watch these all day. And he did. Okay. That's a good question. Those are good. Will it be electrifying? Notice they're done completely differently. Completely. And I'm not going to flunk anyone. Unless you don't turn one in. Yes. You want an out-of-control car. No, that is a real, real problem. And I haven't... right now, I'm just looking for the simpler case. I hear exactly what you're saying, which is, for example, if I'm in a four-way intersection, okay, and for those of you who haven't followed... If I'm in a four-way intersection, and the way everything is really being done, I'm specified by GPS entrance and exit coordinates for each road segment. So correct me, by the way, if I'm wrong in any of the DARPA stuff. But there will effectively be two GPS coordinates. One for going that way, and I suppose we could think of a circle that you could enter there. And you could, I guess, have some that you could go one way, but not the other. So you might be at an intersection and only able to go those two. Now the question is, for certain, when you're going from here to one of these, there's very few lane markers. Although occasionally you find a place like at the top of Cedar Hill where they will put the dashed lines to try and control the maniac drivers or something. Yeah, they'll do things like that, you know, you may have the luxury of something like that. May. In general, you won't. And so, one situation is, yes, you're going to have to seek and find it. You know, let's suppose we come out of here, we turn into, and you're going to go to the GPS coordinate, which is in the center. You really want to, if this is a divided lane road, you really want to be pulling into here and using your algorithm, and this is a mode that we're not in at all right now. In other words, you know, is Dexter going to be doing something like this, hunting? It would be better, by the way, for the cameras to go like this instead of Dexter going like that. But, you know, how do you sort of insert yourself into a lane from a non-lane situation? That is from a very well-marked road segment. One that is. And I think that was sort of the question you were asking. That's why for your final project, we are getting images of roads that don't have those edge markers. More like the real desert challenge. Oh, it is per lane? Oh, okay. Okay, I didn't know that. But still, you've got to, you know, there's an assumption that you're going from a non-lane situation, so whatever algorithm any of you have is picking up nothing. And then all of a sudden, it's going to go into a position where there is something. Now, my assumption is, as I keep telling you, this is going to be done by your different observers, and I'm not sure which is the one that's in charge at that point. All we're doing in here is developing toolboxes of algorithms. The observers are going to say, okay, which one do I let run the vehicle? Which one do I trust? I think that sums it up. But yeah, that's why I want to switch over to the more unconstrained case for your final project. No boundaries, or at least they won't be 19 lanes. Gravel, grass, things like that. Optional projects will be identifying and isolating stop signs or other interesting things. Newman wanted to detect fire hydrants, but I sort of threw water on that idea. So it wasn't a very good one. Whereas stop signs, I think, are better. What he wants to do is dynamically pick up references as you go along and sort of build your own map. But that may be appropriate more for someone's master's thesis. Anyone? Okay. Yeah, you got me diverted on this for a while. I know, but you're shortchanging your education. I've got all of this great stuff to pour into your head. Okay, any questions? Some people have really been putting in a lot of time, but what we're really looking for is not how good your graphics are. What we're really looking for is how well you've tested your algorithm. And this is the kind of stuff that the observer's going to need, because if we know that this is a great algorithm for a high brightness location, okay. Maybe we'll look at average brightness. That'll go into the observer and switch between algorithms. We've got right now, as Andy pointed out, great algorithms, I hope, for the case where the lanes are marked. We're going to have other algorithms for different situations. And we'll be switching between them, or running them in parallel, actually, and maybe switching between the outputs, or rather, the control output hit points to the right control input. Something like that. Okay? So just think, some of you might be running in the desert. No, you don't get a free ticket. Right now, we couldn't afford one. Okay. Where was I? View slideshow. And I think it was about 31. Oh, 40. Okay. Now, I do have one question, which I don't want to forget, just in case. And I'm going to need just a tiny bit of background about your statistics background. Everyone knows what I'm talking about when I talk about means, variances. Okay, that's the really simple part. Expectation values. Anyone not know what I'm talking about when I say an expectation value? Okay. Good enough. Covariance matrix. Okay. We're going to do while I'm planning, I've got my Kalman Filter lecture together. It's currently 75 slides in the first lecture, plus another 25 in the second lecture. I'm using it for vehicle tracking. I'm going to skip most of them, but a lot of them are background, just on statistics. How many people know what an autocorrelation function is? How many don't know? Okay, they're really easy, and lots of times we give them to you. But basically, let me ask you the following question. How many of you know what the inner product between two functions is? The dot product between functions. Have you thought of functions as vectors? How many of you have no idea what he's talking about? Okay, that's what I wanted to know, because we're going to get into a whole lot of concepts that relate to filters and optimal filters. This one right here is not an optimal filter, but I think it's really, really a cool filter concept. And this is a homomorphic filter. If for nothing else, it's got a great name. You know, it sounds really impressive, and you have no idea what in the world it means from its name. Okay, and I'm not even 100% sure. Okay, but the whole idea is, if I have an object, I really don't like that hard chalk. This is an object. I illuminate it, and, you know, maybe it's a light bulb. And this is basically a computer graphics concept, but I illuminate it, and somehow with light. Now, in general, your illuminating source is pretty uniform. This is one of the fundamental concepts. And in fact, if they're artificial sources, you usually try to make them as uniform as possible. If it's the sun, it's pretty far away. It's a point source. Sunlight's pretty uniform. Okay. Kurt, what we're going to get into that a little bit more. Now, throw in, okay, trees and shrubbery. You know, what happens when we take something that's moderately uniform and reflect it off of that? It gets all messed up. Now, we've been thinking in terms of what lately? We've been thinking in terms of filters. We've been thinking in terms of images. We've been thinking in terms of frequencies. Okay? So think about the following. You notice I kept saying this is moderately uniform. The idea is the source illumination is going to be low frequency. All of the detail added by this object, the actual image detail, is high frequency. And the whole idea is, if we can somehow separate the source part of the image from the image part of the image, let's call it the object part of the image, okay? So this will be source and object. We can filter them differently. And that's sort of what a homomorphic filter does. This is actually a diagram. We've got a different gain for low frequency and a different gain for high frequency. And in fact, I'll skip ahead and show you the result. But I really like this, and I wanted to show you the derivation a little bit. What this is actually really good at, this might even have kinds of applications with the images that you might be finding from the camera driving the robot. But you've got a dark area. In this case, it's surrounded by a bright area. And this is the pre-filter result. This is the result of applying a homomorphic filter to it. And notice two things. If you sort of noticed the previous thing that I had up there, the frequency response went like that, where this would be your spatial frequency. So basically, it's a high-pass filter. And we're controlling the low end. By controlling the low end, we're controlling the illumination. That's what allows you to play around in here, in the dark region. And you can bring them in or bring them out by playing with this end of the gain response. And because it's a high pass, notice how it acts like a sharpening filter. It makes the high frequencies, the edges, appear sharper. So this is a really cool filter, but the key thing is the concept of separating the source from the image. Now, how do you mathematically do that? And I'm not going to spend too much time on it, okay? But the basic concept is we've got illumination and reflectance. And it's a product. I mean, that's a standard model. You should have seen that in your computer graphics course. If you've taken one, you don't have to. You know, the concept's pretty reasonable. You shine a light on something and you look at the reflected image. Okay? Now, how would you go about separating something? I mean, this is really simple math now. Well, if you've got a product, how would you separate it? Why not take a log? Convert a product into a sum. And so, define then you're going to ask, oh boy, I bet you're going to really mess up the image. Well, all we want to do is sort of mess with different parts of the image. And I just want to show you the justification here, because that's going to give you a natural log of the illumination plus the natural log of the reflection. Okay? You can Fourier transform and you do a ZUV, and you've got now a Fourier transform of the log of the image. Well, I don't know what that's going to be, but I'll denote the Fourier transform. Okay, and each of those is a frequency-based term, right? We'll have some F illumination of UV, and we'll have some F reflectance of UV. And you see, that's now two terms up there. And this is now where I can filter them differently. This is just a simple mathematical justification for what I was talking about over here. Okay? Because I can take this, which is my log image, do an H Okay. In other words, I'm going to filter it. And H is going to end up being our homomorphic filter. Because now that we've taken the log, we've separated them into clearly different functions. This one's mostly going to be low frequency, and I'm not saying that this one won't have low frequency either, but this one will be concentrated. That is, the illumination will be concentrated at low frequency. This, the reflectance, will be concentrated at high frequency. This is where I apply my filter. So if you see, if you want now, you can see, oh, well, by decreasing gain down here, I can basically get rid of any effects of the source. And don't forget, I'm also changing the brightness because it's including the DC term. But I can do a lot of things with a illumination source. And if you have a source that has shape or something, you can actually get rid of it. Okay, and then at the high frequency end, notice that we actually don't do too much. We sort of just pass the image itself straight through. And then once you do your filtering, you inverse Fourier transform it. Okay, and you will get a modified, if you want to think of it, you'll get a modified I prime and a modified R prime. Okay, they're not going to be the original because you filtered them. You may have suppressed this. You may have made it, actually, you've gotten rid of some variation in it. In essence, you probably averaged this out. So this is actually a really nifty kind of filter. Now, this was actually done, and why did I do something like that filter design? Well, you always want to have things moderately smooth. We learned that when we looked at high-pass filters, low-pass filters. You never want to have a sharp transition in the frequency domain. So this was actually made up. For those of you, it looks almost like an RC response in the frequency domain. And it's based upon our Gaussian filter. So it's a Gaussian transition. And gamma is just the different frequencies. So we're going to have a low and a high. Okay, and this is our value gamma low here. This is our value gamma high here. And think about our frequency term here. This is our standard distance from the center. Okay, so just think about our exponential. If we're at low frequencies, the distance is going to be small. That's going to be effectively 1 minus 1. And so what are you going to have? Just gamma L, the low frequency term. Now, what happens at the other end? At the other end, we get far away. That means we're moving up to high frequency. Okay? This is effectively DUB. So as you move up, okay, this becomes larger and larger. This whole exponential contribution then becomes smaller and smaller, and you end up just with gamma H minus gamma L plus gamma L. Two gamma L's go away, and that's how you get your gamma H. So it's very clever, sort of like the kind of stuff you use with RC circuits. But The way it's designed, you have a nice, smooth Gaussian response. And that means you're not going to get ringing. It's a very good filter. Okay. Now, we're going to talk about plain old FFTs for a while. Okay. And this is the non-centered one. One of the big things that we really haven't talked about much, but I mentioned it in passing. When we take the Fourier transform of our image, and I haven't gone explicitly through all the math, these are discrete Fourier transforms. The implicit assumption is like a Fourier series. It's periodic. And that means images get repeated. That means the spectra get repeated. So, for example, when I take that image, okay, and this is obviously of a little rectangle in the spatial domain, because you've seen this pattern before a couple times. But implicit is, even though we only show the first period, and it goes from minus m over 2 to plus m over 2, if the width in the spatial domain is m pixels, okay, there's this other one hiding out here. And if you go from 0 to m, that's what I actually see in the frequency domain, and that's exactly what you see here. This would be your 0, 0, and you can see things repeating in U and V. They repeat in X and Y. We've always talked about, we do the shift. The shift is that multiply by minus 1 to the x plus y in the space domain. That causes that the shift in the frequency domain is centered. We're going to be dealing a little bit with the periodicity of this because it creates problems. And we had another image earlier, and I can't remember which one it was, where we saw some black bands that started occurring around the edges, and that's aliasing. It's often called wraparound error. It happens when you are Fourier transforming images, especially when you're filtering them, when you're multiplying two images together. I'll show you it in a moment. This is a very famous thing, which we haven't talked about, because MATLAB hides it from you. And the idea is that two-dimensional FFTs can be made up of just repeating one-dimensional FFTs over and over. So if I've got an image, what's very commonly done is I will come in and take my original image, and I will Fourier transform using an FFT each row. So I transform just rows. That's a 1D, a one dimension. It's very, very fast. Then I take this image, and I do the same thing, except I do it vertically now. And that result is the same as doing the 2D. And the reason is, we didn't really look at the math too much, but this is the separability property. And if you have to implement these, oftentimes it's a heck of a lot easier doing a lot of one-dimensional than doing 2D. This is more an implementation speed, but if you look at the actual transform. And the, you've got some, but the key thing is we've got our original image, f of x, y, and we've got a minus j 2 pi ux over m plus vy over m. Okay? And these are the sums over x and y. Those are just over all the textbooks to get your transform. The point is, notice up here in the exponent. It's a sum. Okay? And it's because of that sum that I can do this. Because I can basically pull out for example, do this. Okay? There's one term. I can just transform it, for example, in y. Then, I can come and transform it in z. So basically, I could do this first. And that would be a funny thing, because that's just transformed in one dimension. And then I could come, and you see what I'd be doing is taking this, putting this sum inside that formula that I just erased, and it's exactly the same. So it's because of the exponent in the Fourier transform that I can separate it. And if you have to implement these things, you'll be very interested in that. Now, another thing, we're basically picking up a whole lot of concepts here. Next thing goes by a lot of names. If you are a signal processing person, you call it aliasing. If you are a image processing person, you call it wraparound. And again, the only explanation is that we have to go to the math. And this is actually a fairly nice little graphical explanation of convolution. Now, don't worry. You know, this is not a course in plain old signal processing. But basically, in convolution, you've got something like, and I'm just going to do the digital version. That's basically what we're going to implement. So that's digital convolution. This is what we're doing when we are multiplying something in the frequency domain by a filter in the frequency domain. Except this is what it's doing in the spatial domain. And we're going to have an explanation here that's somewhat spatial domain. And it turns out the solution is spatial domain. And it's easy. That's the only thing you need to remember. Easy solution. So this is illustrated with two really simple waveforms. Two blocks. Or two pulses. So this is F, this is H. In general, F would be your image, H would be your filter. This is a spatial domain filter. And the definition, and you can sort of see it, what we do is basically this is a sum of a product. But before you do it, notice we're summing over M. So the first thing we do is we ignore the x, we flip the waveform. Instead of H of M, it's H of minus M. And that's what we show right here. So here's H of minus M. So we take it, we flip it. Now, what is H of X minus M? That's just a spatially shifted waveform. Okay? So you shift it by an amount X, it moves over. So now, that was the hard part. All you have to do now is you multiply it at each point and sum them all up. Okay? You can sort of see what's going to happen. At this point, when X equals 0, it would be right here. F and H of minus M don't overlap at all. Their product's 0. That's shown right here. And if it's further this way, there will be no product. Again, that's non-zero. So what happens, though, is I start moving over a little. That's my X. And that's what this axis is. This is X, the shift between them. So as I move a little, it's going to overlap a little. I'm going to get a term for my sum. I increase X. That means I move it over more. It's more and more overlap. This is getting bigger and bigger. It will reach a maximum because this waveform is smaller than that one in time, or in space. And what happens then is that it will be constant, and then it will come back down. And notice, you have the original spatial limits, which went, hard to read that axis. I think that's 200. I think that's 200 there and 400 there, 200 there and 400. And notice, in terms of X, we were at 200, 400, and the response goes all the way out to 500. The little, simple result you should come away with is that the response will go out in space. The sum of the two non-zero periods. So this went out to 300, this went out to 200, total is 500 in the convolution. Now, what's all of this about? Remember earlier, I said that images were periodic. You really, when you are doing this Fourier transform stuff, don't have this. You are not multiplying this time, or you are not convolving this with this. What you're actually doing is you're convolving this with this. And this is where all the problems come from. Okay? Because if I have a periodic wave, okay, I flip it, it doesn't make much difference. But notice what happens now. Okay, at zero, okay, I have got this right there. That's overlapping that pulse. So the second, you know, this is the image. This would be the second image, third image. In essence, you're just repeating. This is your original image. You're just repeating it over and over, and this is the size of the image. This would be your N by M. And you just repeat it over and over. That's what's physically going on. But because now what would be this image over here is overlapping the filter response, it's non-zero, where it was zero. Now, it turns out there's a really trivial solution. It's that not good in signal processing. For some of you who know something about signal processing, you never, ever want to mess up your signal. You don't want to do anything to it. Well, it turns out the very, very simple solution in image processing is we're not dealing with time, we're dealing with space. We've got the picture, the whole picture, right there. We don't care about these images. We don't care about these multiple images. We just want them away from our calculations. So what we'll often do, and this is called padding, we'll just take our original image and put zeros around it. Well, at least it did it at exactly the right point. Okay. So if we just put zeros, and that'll make all of that go away. Basically, I put a bunch more zeros in between. Okay? Notice, all it does is it makes... It's like putting zeros like that around your image. And okay. So that makes the... makes it look like it's really something like that. But the point is, who cares? We're only interested in that and processing it. If we put zeros around it, it doesn't matter to us. Okay? And the rule is very simple. How far should you put zeros? Well, you simply take a look at what's the sum of the two non-zero portions. That's how far you need to go out with zeros. So, for example, this has to be not like this, but you have to make it out there with zeros to, let's see, that's 300, that's 200, it's got to go out to 500, it's got to go out to there, zeros. So you're making your image bigger. If it's 512 by 512, well, actually, in this case, it would be 300 by 300. You're making it 500 by 500 with the additional big strips, all zeros. And if you do that, see, we've made them both go out to 500 now. When you do this digital convolution or these frequency domain operations, you get nothing in between. It's nice and clean. You haven't messed up your image. So there's a very simple physical interpretation. And if you're doing a real image, okay, and this is the result of doing a 2D. In fact, this is the Fourier transform of one image multiplied by the Fourier transform of another image. Basically, what's doing over there, we're saying, I want to take an image and a filter. So, in MATLAB, we might do something like FFT2F, multiply it by FFT2H, and we'll do an IFFT2. That's the kind of operation we're doing, but what we want to do is, if one image is size B, well actually, one image is A by B, the other is C by D. I hope I got the horizontal and the vertical thing. What you want to do is you want to pad the image so it's to A plus C minus 1. Or in the other axis, B plus D minus 1. It's just like what we did in that previous figure. You're just putting in, though, a bunch of zeros. This is if you want a really accurate result. Some of you may not give a darn that your values in the resulting image, remember, this is all in the space domain, but this is what we're really doing in the frequency domain. You may not care that you get like black strips or funny strips. And notice, it's usually on the leading edges because that's where you start doing your Fourier transform. Where do we always start? We go here across, because that's the way we always have done our sums. You know, sum from 0 to M, start here and go across, start here and go down. So all of our errors are on the leading edges of the result. Well, if you take that original image, and in some cases, because those are 512 by 512, you get a ton of them, making your pictures twice as big. Four times as much better. You fill it all with zeros, and you will get a perfect result. And you can do things like this. The problem is that your result is four times as big. So what you do after you filter it, you crop it. Now, this is not a great filter. Okay? What kind of filter is that? That's in the spatial domain. Oh, actually, that's right here. You know, it's some kind of padded low-pass filter. In the frequency domain, what does it really probably look like? It probably looks like an ideal one. And then what happens when you Fourier transform the ideal? You get all of that ringing. Remember? So if you have something in your space that is an ideal 2D low-pass filter, you know, those hard edges, actually in this case it's round, so it'll look like that, centered on the origin, you shifted it, but you, if that's in the frequency domain, you Fourier transform it, you shift it, this is what it would look like, there's your classic ringing and all of that, but you have accurate results here and here, and what you do, because this is meaningless, you throw it away. You just keep the original. But the 512 by 512 was padded out to 1024 by 1024. You may just want to say, oh, I don't care if it's not accurate here and here, and just go ahead and do it. I'm warning you that if you want really accurate results, you might get into that. Now, something that's really big and important to us is, I erased it. This is really important now to pattern recognition. This is really important to signal processing. All kinds of very, very useful things. We've been doing filtering. And without saying too much about it, I'll turn the light on for a moment. I was just warning you to dim your eyes there. Okay. Actually, I should have turned on. Jeez. That worked better? Yeah, we'll see. Okay, but the key thing was we were doing filtering, and we just did discrete convolution. And that was our sum, and we'll have a function this now in 2D. That's our discrete convolution. We're summing. And we've usually got our normalization. So that's the convolution. That's the equivalent of multiplying two things in frequency domain. There is something that looks almost identical to this that is really, really useful. And that is discrete correlation. Okay? The only difference between discrete correlation and discrete convolution is these become plus signs. It's exactly the same thing. Now, how many people know what correlation. Okay. How many people aren't sure what correlation is? Okay. Well, you should have had it in all kinds of statistics courses and stuff. But it's got a whole bunch of very simple interpretations in image processing. It's the dot product between two vectors. And what I mean by that, and I'm going to expand it to images in a moment, but this is really important. We're going to use it a lot within the next 2 weeks. Okay. The first thing is the dot product concept. Basically, if I have two vectors, maybe one specified by x1, x2, the other by y1, y2, and that might be vector 1, vector 2, and then r1 dot r2 would be the product of each of those. Some of the components multiply. Okay. Now, you could also do it as magnitude of R1, magnitude of R2, cosine of theta, where this is the angle between them. The key thing is what the dot product is doing is telling us what is the projection of, for example, R2 onto R1? Okay, and that's a very important, very valuable thing to know. Okay, we use it in pattern recognition all the time. Vectors don't have to be vectors. That sounded bad, didn't it? Okay. The vectors don't have a coordinate in a physical space. Okay. I didn't tell you that this was necessarily x and y. Physical coordinate system, did I? I just sort of wrote them. What's a vector? It's just a long string of numbers separated by zeros. It's coordinates and some coordinates. I could have a really big coordinate space that is a waveform. And if I sample it in time, then I map each one of those numbers to this long string of numbers separated by commas. I can make it operate just like a physical vector. Technically, at time t1, I've got a value. At time t2, I've got another value. The string of these together forms a vector. So I can take a function of space, and as a string of numbers represented as a vector, I can do this. How about if I have two strings of numbers? Two functions, I can do exactly like this. I can sum them, and as a result, I can have a dot product between two functions. Now stop and think. If the two functions are exactly the same, what do you get? It's going to be the number times itself, the number squared. It would be positive definite. Every number would add up, and you'd get as large a positive number as you could when they're both exactly the same. When they are not exactly the same, they start to become different. I can have products which might go negative. I have products that won't be as large. Okay? And consequently, consequently, what happens is, this is the correlation. This is the dot product between two waveforms, two functions, or two pictures. And the idea is, maybe I want to find teeth in an image. And this is sort of interesting. Imagine that you take this tee, it's a little template, and I move it all around. Notice how the mathematics is so similar to what I did before with spatial filters and everything, but it's a correlation. I just move it around in space. At every point, I compute the product of, for example, this coordinate by that. So I'm doing basically that little template. I move over. I do it again. Move over. When the functions don't match, I usually get a small number. When the functions match perfectly, when that T perfectly matches that, at every point I get the maximum positive value, they all add up in a positive way, I get a large number. And so consequently, if what I do now is I plot not the result of spatial filtering, but the result of spatial correlation, what's going to happen? I'm going to get my largest value. And why, since I'm doing it in 2D, let's show the result as an image. That's what I've shown here. So at this point, it had a low value. Low value. Where's it going to get a real high value? Right here. Notice, that is the brightest spot in the image. That's the highest correlation. This is now a way for you to define teeth in an image. Now, you can do this with all kinds of other stuff. Okay, maybe you want to find little round things, rectangular things, whatever. You can move all of these different shapes through here and get correlation coefficients. Now, don't go thinking that correlation coefficients are the greatest thing since sliced bread. They're not. Rotate T. It won't find any of it. Orbit. The problem is it is not an invariant feature. Or it doesn't recognize it irregardless of pose, orientation, rotation, size, etc. We call that invariance in image processing. And actually in AI. We want our feature recognition to be invariant. There are all kinds of techniques for doing that. But correlation is a rather useful thing. It's used an awful lot in OCR, optical character recognition, and a lot of things. And correlation is going to really come in as we're going to start studying how do you clean up messed up images, and how do you get into optimal filters, how do you do really weird things in the frequency domain. We're going to do Wiener filters, Kalman filters, not in great detail. If we did, you'd have to be taking, actually I'd have to teach you what Laparo is doing in random signals. Anyone in here taking random signals? You took it. Okay. And you probably saw nothing but autocorrelation functions, integrals all over the place. We're going to do them in multiple dimensions. Then we're going to start taking derivatives of them with respect to variables and optimize them. I know you're looking forward to that. I'm going to give you most of the results. I'm going to show you how they work. But we're not going to derive most of the detailed math. And at the conclusion, you should know what the difference is between a Wiener filter, a Kalman filter, and a bunch of different kinds of filters. So how's that? So we're going to collect our toolbox, and if you really want to do stuff, you go out and you get the Kalman filter toolbox for MATLAB, or the Wiener filter toolbox, or whatever toolbox you want. There are toolboxes for them. And by the way, when you see particularly the Kalman filter and some of these, oh, problem is ugly.
Matrices everywhere. Okay.